Hey everybody, if you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store. Whether you sell physical, digital, or service products, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Attention Orlando and New Orleans. Stuff You Should Know is coming to your town October 9th and 10th, which is soon, which means the time to buy tickets is running out. And FYI, our shows tend to sell out. So go to sysklive.com and you'll find links to tickets and info, and you should probably go now. We'll see you in October. And if you want to come see me do my End of the World live show, I'll be in Chicago on September 12th and in Austin, Texas on October 2nd. Ticket links are weirdly hard to find, so just search End of the World Josh Clark Austin or Chicago and your friendly search engine will help you out. See you in Orlando, New Orleans, Chicago, and Austin.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to the horror show. I'm Josh. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. There's Jerry over there. And we are about to pass out from nausea.
Yeah, I think we need to issue a strong COA.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe some parents might, it depends on what you title this thing, they might think Ed Gein was like a children's show host or something.
Yeah, I guess that's possible. So, yeah, it's a good idea. We preface this with, this one is really just not for kids.
No.
I don't even know what age it would really start. Maybe 14, 15?
I don't know. It's really grisly and gross.
Yeah, maybe no one should listen to this. How about that? before we get even further started, just let me throw one more thing in, okay?
Okay.
I am doing an End of the World live show in Chicago on September 12th. Just saying. So if anybody wants to go see, you can get tickets to come see me do my End of the World live show in Chicago on September 12th at lh-st.com. Enough said.
That's great.
Thanks, Chuck. So we're talking about Ed Gein, who is most decidedly not a children's show host, although ironically, he was a babysitter from time to time.
Yeah.
That was maybe the most shocking thing I've ever read in my life.
Yeah, although, I mean, it doesn't seem like he posed much. I mean, obviously he was a threat to anything, but that was not his MO.
No, kids weren't, which we'll see later. Some people are like, it doesn't matter. He's probably still a child killer. It just doesn't fit. There, he had a very specific MO for sure as far as killers go. And he doesn't qualify, as far as I know, as a serial killer, although I think that's just silly. But he failed to hit the big three mark, I guess, is what it takes to be a serial killer.
Well, proven at least.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So he's possibly a serial killer, I guess. And if you have never heard of Ed Gein, fret not. We're going to tell you all about him. But I would wager that you have at least encountered some character based on him, because there's probably no real life killer or criminal. No, we'll just stick with killer, who's inspired more utterly deranged characters than Ed Gein has.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we know the big three are, of course, Psycho with Norman Bates, Texas Chainsaw Massacre with Leatherface.
Sure.
And, of course, Silence of the Lambs with Hannibal Lecter.
There was James Gunn, who was
based on... Oh, well, that's
on,
true. Yeah. James Gunn was the Buffalo Bill character.
Right, exactly. Who
just
wanted
by many
to,
names.
Right.
None of which are Hannibal Lecter.
No. Hannibal Lecter was even like, man, that guy's off his rocker.
You think?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I think he was kind of like this. Maybe at least he felt he was sloppy or something. He definitely knew he was smarter than that guy. So yeah. I think he looked down on him in one way or another.
Okay.
So Ed Gein's story starts, as so many of our stories start, at birth. Back in 1906 in Wisconsin, he was born little Edward Theodore Gein. And I'd like to say, like, things started out normally, but I don't get the impression that there was a single normal day in Ed Gein's entire life. He just really pulled up the short straw, as it were, as far as the birth lottery goes.
Yeah, he, you know, his father was an abusive alcoholic. Mm-hmm. His mother, she owned a grocery store for a little while in La Crosse, Wisconsin, but she was, Augusta was by all accounts a mentally ill religious zealot, overbearing. There needs to be a stronger word in this case.
Super overbearing?
Super overbearing mother.
Yeah. Times infinity?
Yeah. And the religious, the religious stuff is just off the charts as far as anything to do with sex and intercourse was the worst dirty possible thing imaginable, and that she hammered this into her two boys.
She really did. Hammer by, I guess, grabbing their genitalia sometimes and railing at them about how this is the devil's unit or whatever she'd call it. I don't know. She probably could have called it the devil's unit. I don't think it's entirely impossible. But she realized, she looked around their town of La Crosse, Wisconsin, and said, this place is a sinkhole of filth. There's a quote from her. I guess it's Ed Gein doing an impression of his mom, which we'll find out later he really liked to do a lot. And she moved her whole family, sold the family grocery store, and moved from La Crosse, Wisconsin, to a little town called Plainfield, which had a population of about 500. And Plainfield was, it had been established decades before, but it was still so small that they'd only built the fire station and the local school within the last like 7-8 years. It was a very tiny little town. And so you'd think like, okay, maybe Augusta Gein could relax a little bit here. Not so.
Yeah. Did you look up a picture of her?
I didn't actually. I don't think I have ever seen her.
Yeah. She looks like you would think.
Yeah, I think I just had such a mental image of her, I assumed I knew what she looked like.
Yeah, she does not look friendly, let's put it that way.
I could see that hair in a kind of a tight bun, maybe, and then with the calico lace neck dresses.
Yeah, I mean, no one smiled in pictures back then, but she, in the only photo that I found, was especially good at the photo scowl.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, they moved to Plainfield where she thought things would be better, I guess, and not a sinkhole of filth. Mm-hmm. And it was not any better. There was no place that Augusta Gein could have gone that would have been suitable for her.
I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, because there were other human beings there. And I think she considered just about everyone filth unless they were, you know, maybe the preacher. And who knows, she may have considered her preacher filth.
I could see that. And she definitely considered her husband filth.
Consider her husband filth and women, you know, any woman that had been on a date with another man, she had bad things to say about, it seems like.
Yeah. So that was actually not a good move for the family. You know, they've been doing okay from what I could tell, as far as they could do okay with an abusive alcoholic, shiftless father and an angry mom. In La Crosse, I think they'd been doing better financially. They moved to Plainfield and they started farming. And their dad was fairly useless to begin with. But secondly, the soil, the land, they were not used to farming this kind of sandy soil, or they didn't have any idea what they were doing with farming anyway. So they had a really hard time growing crops. And then apparently the neighbors weren't the friendliest neighbors around, so nobody stepped in to help them and show them what to do. So they endured some real hardship on the farm. That was problem one. Problem two was Ed Gein was not one to leave the house very much. And when he did, he went to school. And it's not like school was a respite for him or a place to escape from. It was just as hellish as it was at home, basically.
Yeah, it was pretty bad for Ed. He had a weak eye on one side. He had a growth on his tongue that made him talk different than the rest of the kids. He had sort of a effeminate appearance. And all of this, you know, and And this is bad at any time in history, probably, in when you're a little kid in school.
Sure.
But back then, it was really bad. And, of course, he was bullied and teased, and he would come home crying, and his father would beat him for crying and call him a sissy.
Mm-hmm.
And things are really getting out of hand. Like, his mom won't let he or Henry really leave much at all. So they're just stuck in isolation where his psychosis, and, you know, later found out to be seriously mentally ill, obviously. But it certainly didn't help to be in this kind of environment.
Not at all. But, I mean, this was life for him. This is how he lived. He and his older brother, Henry, who had him by, I think, 4 years or something like that. This was their life. And Henry had, like, this... He was not as wrapped up in their mother as Ed was, not by a long shot. Henry felt totally comfortable criticizing his mother. He saw her as mentally imbalanced. He was just not under her spell like Ed was. But that's how they grew up. That's how they lived. And she made them both promise that they would die virgins because sex was just so awful and dirty. And then in 1940, the family... took a turn for the different when George, their dad, died of a heart attack. And that actually kind of opened up Ed's life a little bit more. Number one, he had his mom all to himself, right? But number two, just by virtue of having to go out and make more money, he had to go out of the house and do things like odd jobs and babysit and that kind of stuff. So it changed his life a little bit, but it's not like it had any big lasting effects for the better.
Yeah, for sure. He didn't quite have her to himself yet because Henry was still around.
That's true.
But Eddie, you know, like you said, he didn't travel much. I think the furthest he ever traveled away from his house was one time when he was 36. He went to Milwaukee, 150 miles away, for military inspection where he did not get in to the military because of his lazy eye, which could have changed the course of his history, you know.
For sure.
Had he gotten accepted into military service and gotten out from under the thumb of his mother.
Mm-hmm. Could have changed the course of a lot of people's history, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. So 4 years later, after Dad dies, he and his brother, they're working at the house, they're burning some brush, the fire gets out of control, and then Henry is found dead, and everyone's like, you know, he died in this fire. Upon a little bit of investigation, and it seems like that's about all they did, there was bruising on Henry's head and neck, and they listed his cause of death as being asphyxiation anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And like we said earlier, it was never proven, but it seems like since Ed led them to the body, even though he said he couldn't find Henry during the fire, yet here's where he is.
It's a little fishy.
It was all fishy. So, you know, to this day, people say that Ed killed his brother, and that was probably his first murder.
Yeah, which is a pretty significant first murder, murdering your own brother, you know?
Yeah.
So now Ed really does have his mom to himself. But apparently, from what I read, her health took a really bad turn for the worse after Henry died. She really took it hard. And so in less than a year, she suffered a stroke and was basically housebound, if not bedbound, and Ed took care of her, which I get the impression that Ed was more than happy to take care of his mom day and night.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it was a just such a twisted manipulation that was going on because on one hand, she's just screaming at him and calling, putting him down, calling him a failure and a weakling. And then other times she would call him into bed to like sleep with her and hold her, and she would whisper to him and say that he could spend the night in her bed and stuff. So like he didn't know which way was up.
It was just standard elderly mom and middle-aged son stuff, you know, but we all go through it. It's true. We've all crawled into our mom's bed and slept the night at age 45, but this didn't go very well for Ed. He still was lapping it up, though. Here's the thing. He was so devoted to his mom that any attention from her, negative, positive, whatever, would have been like that. He needed that. That was normal to him, however he got it. So he took care of her. He cared for her one way or another. And she died in 1945, which is what? Was that a year after his brother died?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she didn't even last a year after Henry died. She dies of, from what I saw, was pneumonia and probably another stroke. And now here's the thing. Ed Gein, who was almost never allowed to leave the farm, and when he did, he encountered people who were extraordinarily unfriendly to him. He had turned into a bit of a weirdo, you could say, even just from the outside, just from, you know, what normal people knew about him in town. He was considered an oddball and a weirdo, but generally harmless. But now he was totally and utterly alone on this family farm. And the first thing he did was board up his mom's rooms so that he could establish a shrine to her. The rest of the house, though, kind of fell into what you would call disrepair.
Yeah, I mean, there was serious neglect at that point. He didn't seem to care about keeping the house up, except for that pristine room where mommy lived. Mm-hmm. He started getting into some unusual things like anatomy books and pornography and horror novels, pulp horror, Nazi books about Nazi atrocities. Mm-hmm. And he would start to go out a little bit. He generally still stayed around the farm. And like we said earlier, unbelievably worked as a babysitter and as a handyman around town. So he started to kind of appear a little bit in town, and no one thought a lot about the guy, except like the occasional time when he would stop in at this pub, Mary Hogan's in Pine Grove, and he would say weird things about some horror novel or some Nazi book that he was reading, to the point where people were like, that's a very... To talk about headhunting and sex change operations, this is what they called it back then.
Right.
It's an odd thing to talk about in 1945 at a bar.
In rural Wisconsin, especially.
For sure.
And he would also, he had a weird habit of like laughing suddenly apropos of nothing that anyone else could put their finger on. So it seemed a lot like he was laughing at his own jokes, that kind of stuff. He was an odd dude. But again, the town was... They considered him so harmless and so trustworthy that they would let him babysit their children. He wouldn't hurt a fly. He had a reputation, from the way that people put it, of not going deer hunting with the rest of the guys, which, I mean, like, if you don't go deer hunting in Wisconsin in the 40s and 50s, what is wrong with you? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he was known to be too squeamish to do something like deer hunting. So he didn't deer hunt. That's how the town viewed him. And if you look back, though, there were a lot of red flags that he was putting up that, in retrospect, with all of the information that the townsfolk later had, really seemed very fishy, that they were just kind of waving off a lot of stuff. Like, for example, that bar owner, the bar he went to, Mary Hogan's Tavern, she disappeared. And no one knew where she went for 3 years. She just vanished. There was a little bit of blood left behind at the bar. But one night, as she was closing the bar down, she just vanished. And Ed used to joke about how Mary was staying at his house for the night. And the townspeople thought that was weird, but not necessarily remarkable. Maybe a little tasteless. But in reality, he had murdered Mary Hogan back in 1954.
Should we take a break right there?
Oh, yeah. That was an abrupt cliffhanger.
We're on the wrong side of the cliff.
Yeah, we are.
We'll come back right after this.
Okay. Hey everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
Stuff you know. Stuff you should know.
All right, so we're back on the wrong side of a cliffhanger.
Well, wait a minute. So Mary Hogan disappeared. What happened, Chuck? What possibly happened to Mary Hogan?
She was murdered.
By who?
By Ed Gein on December 8th, 1954.
What? I didn't see that coming.
He shot her. He shot her with a .32 caliber pistol. Put him into his pickup truck, mm-hmm. and took her back to the farm. And this is not something that was known until 1957, when everything really unraveled. It was a full 3 years, though, that he was still in town and, I guess, occasionally making a joke about what happened to Mary.
Right. So when you say things unraveled for him one night, like, they found out everything. They went from thinking he was just an odd little dude who wouldn't even kill a deer to coming across the most depraved, deranged human being in the history of American crime up to that point. There may have been people to come later on, mm-hmm. but Ed Gein was the first truly depraved killer in America that America had ever known. Prove me wrong, somebody who loves true crime. Prove me wrong.
Yeah, and here's the thing. He was, he had survived things like the local kids coming by, peeking in his house, and saying they saw shrunken human heads hanging in the living room.
Yeah.
And he survived all that and laughed it off and said that, my cousins served in the South Seas in World War II and sent these little heads back as souvenirs.
Whereas not that the kids are, like, wrong or mistaken. It's, no, I've got shrunken heads. They're just souvenirs.
Yeah, but as it turns out, they were real human heads.
Right. So they were real human heads. They weren't from the South Seas. And Ed had shrunk them himself, actually. He had read some books on that kind of thing and probably talked about it at the bar, which he probably regretted when those teenagers started running their mouths around town. But he didn't have to worry about that for very long because in November of 1957, he went to the local hardware store, Warden's Hardware Store. And Warden's Hardware Store was owned and operated by a woman named Bernice Warden. And she was working that day. It was toward the end of the day. And Ed Gein came in. He needed a jar of antifreeze. And she sold it to him, filled out a receipt, gave him the receipt. And I guess presumed that that was done. Their business was done. But Ed walked over to the wall and got down a .22 caliber rifle and pulled a .22 caliber shell out of his pocket, put it in the rifle, and then shot Bernice Warden in her head. And he apparently then, and this is where the podcast really starts to get grisly, everybody, so just buckle in or maybe press stop here. But the amount of blood that they would later find in this hardware store was so much that they presumed that Ed cut Bernice Warden's throat after he shot her in the head and then dragged her to the loading dock where he took her body away.
That's right. So he put the rifle back on the rack, mm-hmm. Didn't even bother to take out the shell that he had brought, took the cash register, and I don't get the idea that that was to make it appear as if it were a robbery even. I think he just needed the money probably.
That's possible.
Although who knows. But Bernice Warden had a son named Frank, and he was a deputy, and he came back into town after deer hunting, like everyone did in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. in the 1940s.
Except Ed.
He stopped by the old hardware store, and it was very odd to him because she was not there. The door was unlocked. The back door was open. And then he notices a little trail of blood from the front to the back door, and very quickly and easily just looked at the little receipt pad, saw that half gallon of antifreeze was the last receipt made out to Ed Gein, called the sheriff, and they went to Gein's farmhouse to question him, and very quickly found Bernice Worden behind the house hanging in what's called the summer kitchen. I guess it's where you go when it's really hot to cook that's not inside the house.
Yeah.
And again, this is where it gets super grisly. You've got one more chance to stop.
Turn back now.
But he basically treated her as if he had been deer hunting. She was disemboweled and dressed like a deer, hanging naked upside down from a pulley, beheaded and fully dressed and butchered like a deer would be.
So I want to just restate something. One of the two people who found her was her son. Like, he walked into the summer kitchen, and there is his beheaded, disemboweled mother hanging by her ankles in Ed Gein's summer kitchen. Just, like, imagine that. Like, if you read all of the accounts of this stuff, no one ever stops and points out that, like, poor Frank Worden found his mother like this. But he did, and the sheriff was there, too. And very quickly, they called for backup. And back in the day in rural Wisconsin, backup meant like all the neighbor folk, all the men in the surrounding county were deputies, basically. So they all showed up, and pretty soon they launched this investigation of Ed Gein's house. And in very short order, Ed Gein's house would be known as the House of Horrors. And that's a pretty good name for it, actually, considering what they found there, because they caught Ed Gein basically right in the act of field dressing Bernice Worden. But this is definitely not his first rodeo as far as that was concerned.
No, but it appears as if it was only the second time that he had ever actually killed someone.
You're right.
What they found was really disturbing. You know, human body parts used in exactly the ways that they were in Silence of the Lambs, as far as like using human skin and human bones and skulls to make into other things.
Handicrafts.
Yeah, I mean, the most horrifying stuff that you could imagine. And they realized that it was probably about 15 women in total, you know, from all the various parts that they were able to get together. And he had only killed two of them. So that presented a bit of a conundrum until Ed Gein said, basically, you know what I do? I'm digging up people from their graves.
Yeah, he said that later on, he was caught just so utterly red-handed, it was ridiculous. But they spent hours and hours, like maybe 10, 12 hours during that first investigation. And it wasn't a big house, but they were just turning up so much horrible, twisted, bizarre stuff made out of body parts that it just took that long to catalog and comb through everything. But he said, no, I've been robbing graves because I am capable of raising the dead. So I go and rob graves. And the first grave I ever robbed was my mother's grave about a year and a half after she died back in 1945. I went to the gravesite, dug her up. I opened her casket, and I pulled her head clean off of her body with my bare hands, which is the grisliest thing any human being has ever done in their entire life in the history of the world.
Yeah, but it's interesting in that they never went and exhumed the gravesite as part of the investigation, which is really strange. So they're taking Ed Gein's word for it, I guess.
They had dug up other ones, Chuck, so I don't know if maybe they were just satisfied that, like,
probably,
once they found one or two, they're like, fine, we'll believe you on the rest of them.
And I guess maybe in the 1940s that was, like, they got their man, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that would have done in the case of his mother's grave, you know?
Sure. It's like, hey, whatever you do to your mother's 18-month-old corpse is your business, I guess.
I don't think that was the case.
Okay.
But this is where Errol Morris weirdly comes into the story. And I feel like we talked about this on another episode at some point.
Oh, really? This was news to me.
But Errol Morris, the documentary filmmaker, he was going to do a story about Ed Gein, spent about a year in Plainfield in the 70s doing his research that he never made the film. But his pal Werner Herzog, they had sort of a interesting relationship over the years. But Werner Herzog said, you know what, we are going to go back and dig up the grave in the dead of night.
Nice.
Errol. And Errol did not show up. And no, apparently but Herzog did, though.
They had like an appointed night and day and time and everything, and Herzog was there ready, probably with a shovel or two and maybe some coffee and donuts.
I would imagine snacks were not in order, but you never know.
I think Errol Morris made the right decision in that case. Because, you know, grave robbing, even for verification for a research project or research for a project, that's, you don't want to do that kind of thing. So as far as we know then, no one has ever verified Ed's story about him taking his mother's head. But there's a lot of other good evidence that was the case, that he did do that, because one of the things they found in his house were faces, human faces of women. And this is a really important point here. Women all roughly of the same age, build, look kind of, and all of those women happen to look kind of like his mother. And so over the years, a lot of people have said, like, why did he do this? What was the problem? But one of the first psychiatrists after he was caught, and we'll talk a little more about him being caught, but one of the first psychiatrists who examined him said, I'm pretty sure I have figured out why this guy did this. He was robbing graves and trying to resurrect the dead when really he was trying to resurrect his mother. And he was robbing the graves of women who looked like her. Both of the women, Mary Hogan and Bernice Worden, who he murdered, they bore a rough resemblance to his mom. And so what he was ultimately doing in his head was creating a substitute mother or recreating his mom, reanimating his mom so that she could never leave him again because he brought her back from death. In reality, if you were a teenager looking through Ed Gein's window at night, he was dressing up in a suit of skin made from women who he'd murdered or whose graves he'd dug up so that he could pretend more accurately to be his mother.
That's right. He admits, like you said, he was caught super red-handed, so he admitted fully to those murders, although the confession about Hogan was ruled inadmissible because they basically, you know, beat him to a pulp while he was in the waiting room.
Well, plus also with Bernice Worden, he always said that it was an accident, which is BS, but that he never confessed to purposefully murdering her.
That's right. It was, you know, inappropriately or I guess inaccurately relayed that there was a human heart and a frying pan on the stove. It turns out that was not true, but that was enough to get rumors started that he was a necrophile, that he was a cannibal and was eating human organs because human organs were found all over the place. Mm-hmm. It seems like that's probably not true. But maybe we should take a break and talk a little bit about the trial of Ed Gein and what happened right after this.
Well, wait a minute. Before we take a break, Chuck, let's just say he was convicted. We'll be right back right after this. All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on. Hey, everybody. Did you know that Boricua is the name for someone from Puerto Rico? But it's more than just a name. It's a way of life and representation of the vibrant spirit of the island.
Yeah, that's right. It's an island that's filled with adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the entire United States.
That's right. Or you can get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico that remind you of why you travel in the first place.
Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you.
That's right. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Stuff you know. Stuff you should know.
So we're on the other side of a cliffhanger again.
That's right. Ed Gein has a lawyer named William Belter, who throws in not guilty by reason of insanity plea. And at the time, he was found unfit to stand trial in 1958 because they diagnosed him as having schizophrenia. And he went to Central State Hospital, where he stayed for 10 years until they finally did say, you are fit to stand trial, 10 years later. Mm-hmm. And then sort of anticlimactically, he was found guilty of the murder of Bernice Worden, but found insane at the time. So basically, just go back to Central State Hospital.
Right. And he petitioned years after that in 1974 to be released. He was like, okay, maybe I was crazy at the time. I'm not anymore. Let me out. And they said, no. He said, okay. And he never tried again.
Yeah, I don't think he would have had much of a shot.
No, apparently the guy, the doctor, the director of the hospital, the Central State Hospital, used to receive pretty frequently death threats if he ever let Ed Gein out.
Yeah, I'm sure that he didn't even need those.
No. So a lot of people, including the judge who presided over Ed Gein's case in 1968, who went on to write a book, strongly suspect Ed Gein was responsible for other disappearances and murders, not just his brother Henry's, but also some local ones. There were two hunters who went missing in 1951. The only thing that was ever found of them was one of their jackets and their dog, one of their dogs. But they and their car just vanished mysteriously. And Ed Gein was later questioned about it. He said, I didn't kill him, but my neighbor did, and I can show you where the bodies are. And I guess the authorities went, nah, that's okay. There was an 8-year-old girl who went missing, a 15-year-old girl who went missing. And so some people think that Ed Gein really did kill multiple people. And it's possible because he still never admitted to murdering Bernice Worden, right? So maybe he did and he just would have never fessed up. I don't know. But it does, like you were saying way earlier, it goes against his MO, murdering kids and then murdering men. What he was after were women that looked like his mother. That was my impression.
Yeah, and as you would expect, a house like this, after something like this goes on, becomes, it was already sort of the stuff of legends, because of kids poking their face in and seeing, you know, heads hanging on the wall. But after this happened, like, you can imagine exactly, like, what happens. People are coming by to see the house, driving by the House of Horrors, vandalizing the House of Horrors. They posted notice eventually that the contents of the house and the farm were going to be auctioned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, understandably, the townspeople went nuts. They're like, you can't auction this stuff out. We've already got enough problems with the notoriety in our little quiet small town that we all love.
Population 500.
And on March 20th, they took matter into their own hands, seemingly, allegedly, because the house burned to the ground one night and they never caught who did it, but it's pretty clear that it was an entire town of people with pitchforks and torches.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're handing out like Kool-Aid and saltines at that thing as refreshments. I think the whole town did it, you know?
Yeah, but it did not stop the curiosity of this house, of course.
It didn't. I mean, like, people still came and still do go to see the lot where this was. But it did. It was probably pretty effective to cut down a lot of looky-loos. There was no real pilgrimage or shrine for people to go to with just an empty field. I think maybe, like, the driveway's still there. I don't know. It's not much to look at. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot less people that come to Plainfield. But a couple of things were auctioned off, one of which was supposedly his cauldron, where he kept disemboweled and bowels, I guess. That has not necessarily ever been proven as correct. It actually is his cauldron. It's just allegedly his cauldron. But his car was definitely auctioned off. And there was a bidding war that started between like 14 bidders. And the winning bid was from Bunny Gibbon, who is a carnival sideshow operator who bought the car to promote at sideshows. And Bunny Gibbon started promoting it as Ed Gein's Ghoul Car, which he used to transport bodies to and from the grave and transported Bernice Worden back to his house. And Bunny Gibbons put a mannequin in the car as Ed Gein as the driver and a mannequin as Bernice Worden's body and charged 25 cents to come take a peek at it.
Yeah, and he sold a lot of those admission tickets.
Mm-hmm.
Sold like 2,000 of them over a two-day period.
That's a lot for a carnival, you
know? It is. And, you know, people are attracted to the macabre and kind of always have been. So he made a little money, although it was very controversial, and he got some good bad publicity because of it,
mm-hmm.
which was fine with him. But at some point, some of these fairs started to say, no, we're not going to let you come in here and bring this car in here. We're basically going to shut you down. The sheriff arrived at one and shut him down. And then he basically said, you know what? I'm taking my car onto greener pastures in Illinois, where hopefully I'll be able to show my car there.
Yeah, I guess Illinois was fine with it, or it just petered out or something, because after that, the trail kind of goes cold, and no one has any idea what became of Ed Gein's car. So it may be out there somewhere. It may be in parts in different cars. It may just be a cube. Who knows? It may be part of your refrigerator. Could be. But no one knows what happened to Ed Gein's car.
Yeah, we do know what happened to Ed Gein's cauldron. If that was, in fact, his cauldron.
Mm-hmm.
A woman named Evelyn Mayer bought it in 1958 and planted flowers in it, representing the victims. 50 years later, her grandson, Dan McIntyre, found it in his parents' garage, had it verified by people from the auction that they were, you know, they at least say that was the one.
Mm-hmm.
And then 4 years ago, it was auctioned off and now is on display at Basin's Haunted Museum in Las Vegas.
Wow. I would go see that, wouldn't you?
I don't know.
I don't know if I would fly out to Vegas to see it or anything like that, but if I were walking down the street and they're like, come on in, I'd probably go in.
I don't think, I'm not interested in that stuff.
I want to also, let me give a shout out, because I hadn't heard anything about the cauldron before, but I found out about that from the site Cult of Weird. You ever heard of Cult of Weird?
I'm not sure.
It's a good little site, and I think they might actually be based in Wisconsin, so just want to tip my hat to them for teaching me about Ed Gein's cauldron.
Interesting.
So, Chuck, when Ed Gein was still alive, he was very much a legend. He didn't die until 1984. And long before that, he was basically made into this legendary boogeyman when the first character that was based on him hit the big screen. It was Norman Bates in Hitchcock's Psycho. And Hitchcock had made this movie based on a book that had come out, I think, the year before by an author named Robert Block, also called Psycho. And Block was from Wisconsin, so he kind of fashioned the meat of the story or the bones of the story around the Ed Gein crimes.
Was that intentional?
The bones or the meat?
Yeah.
You know what's really sad is it absolutely wasn't.
Oh, interesting.
I was like, "What? Why are you making that face? I don't understand."
The next movie was a little more on the nose. In 1974, there was a low-budget movie called Deranged,
mm-hmm.
and it was about a killer named Ezra Cobb, but it was very clearly modeled on Ed Gein. And when you look at even the production stills of this thing, he's like eating brains out of a skull and making suits of skin. It looks really pretty horrific. It was a Canadian movie. But
oh, man.
It starred as Ezra Cobb, a.k.a. Ed Gein, one Roberts Blossom, one of my favorite character actors who is no longer with us.
What else was he in?
He played Old Man Marley in Home Alone.
Oh, okay. Wow.
That guy.
Wow. I'll bet he did a good Ed Gein.
He did. And when he was younger, he looked, if you think he was scary in Home Alone, you should have seen him when he was in his 20s.
I can imagine. Those Canadians, man, they'll make a ghastly film. Have you ever seen Strange Brew? I actually love that movie.
Yeah, I bet you that. I'm not sure if that one ages. I'd be curious.
I was like, come on, what's a movie associated with Canada? Come on, Josh, come on. So the next up was actually the same year. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre came out the same year that Deranged did. And Tobe Hooper knew about the Ed Gein story because he had relatives in Wisconsin who were like, listen to this. And they told him, he said, I'm going to grow up to make a crazy movie about this based on this someday. And he did. He made the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was one of the all-time great, not just horror movies, but indie movies of all time.
For sure.
Have you ever read, there's a Texas Monthly, like, long-form article about the making of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Have you ever read it?
No, but Texas Monthly is a pretty good rag.
It is a good rag. I think maybe Skip Hollandsworth wrote it. They've got a few really great writers there. But they used to, there was another, like, much, much bigger, like, studio film shooting in the area at the same time. And the crew from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre would go to that set and act like they worked there for catering, like during lunch and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They would go steal catering food and just pose like they were supposed to be there, and then they go back and film some more. Although they also frequently get kicked off a set and get caught.
I went to a catering truck or two in my neighborhood in L.A. when I wasn't working on them.
Well, you're letting them, you're not ruining their shots, so they owe you, you know?
No, I was just getting a breakfast burrito occasionally. So as far as Gein, well, of course, we mentioned Silence of the Lambs in 1991. But as far as Gein goes, he was a model prisoner. I guess in the home where he was, it wasn't a prison.
Well, he was incarcerated. He wasn't allowed to leave. So
yeah, I mean, do you call him a prisoner though, I guess? Or a patient?
Patient, inmate, maybe? How about inmate?
All right. He was a model inmate. There was one quote from a cook that said Eddie was normally a very unassuming, quiet, helpful kind of guy. You didn't know what he had done. You would think nothing of him. And like you said, he died there in 1984. Of cancer and respiratory illness on July 26, and was buried in Plainfield with his family at 3 a.m., obviously, in the dead of night, ironically, across from a grave that he had robbed. But they smartly eventually removed his headstone and put it in storage because it was stolen in 2000. Then they found it in Seattle a few months later. They were like, let's just leave this unmarked between Henry and Augustus graves.
Really, what good is it doing? Like, what are they saving it for, you know?
Oh, I mean, there may be laws against destroying a headstone. Who knows?
Oh, I'll bet you're right. I'll bet you're right. So, yeah, you can go visit their graves now, and the gap in between their headstones, is that's where Ed Gein is buried. And there's one more thing. Like, a lot of people talk about cannibalism. A lot of people talk about necrophilia, but it's not at all clear that he ever ate any person and that he ever engaged in any actual, like, sex act with anybody that he murdered or dug up. And in fact, remember, he promised his mother that he would remain a virgin his whole life. He said that he had never had a sexual encounter with anybody else, living or dead, just himself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was it. So he's probably not a necrophile either. Well, that's it for Ed Gein. Wow, this was a ghastly episode, wasn't it, Chuck?
Yeah.
If you want to know more about Ed Gein, well, there's a lot that you could go read. Like, we purposefully didn't really go into the stuff that they found at his house. It was really bad. So if this floated your boat and you want to get all sicko, go check it out. In the meantime, it's time for listener mail.
This is called Eyewitness Identification. Real life story here. Hey guys, a few years ago I saw a man crouching by my neighbor's bike, which he kept locked to a chain fence between our properties. Mm-hmm. Watched for a few moments to confirm he was working towards stealing the bike. When I asked him what he was doing, he muttered nothing. And I said, well, it kind of looks like you're trying to steal my neighbor's bike, so I'm going to call the cops now. First of all, Karen, I don't know if that was... You shouldn't probably engage that man.
That's true, but it was a pretty hilarious line.
Yes. He ignored me and continued, so I stood there about 5 feet away, separated by that chain link fence.
He continued?
And describing his clothing and features to the police over the phone. When the dispatcher asked how old he looked, it took everything in me not to pause and ask him his age. So, unfortunately, the man got away with the bike before the cops arrived, so they drove around looking for him. Came back a while later with a man on a bike who did bear a very close resemblance to the thief. Even the clothes were super similar. The guy matched the description I had given so closely the cops could not believe it when I repeated, no, he's not the guy. The only reason I was so certain is because I really took the time to look at him for a moment. I'm a terribly unobservant person, and it really made me realize what a poor witness I would make after the fact. How hard it can be to note those necessary details when your brain is on autopilot. They were never able to catch the petty bike thief, but very glad they didn't arrest the innocent man. And how dumb am I for standing next to a criminal while I call the cops on him?
Well, at least she knows now. She's got some perspective now.
Yeah, she says this is before our camera phones and such, so next time I'll just snap a picture.
Yeah. Sir, can you look at me? Great. Thank you.
And that is from Karen in Memphis. And Karen said, come do a show in Memphis. She said, you guys could sell out the Orpheum, no problem.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I looked it up. The Orpheum seats 2,500, so.
Oh, I don't
know. Karen, we could not sell out the Orpheum, no problem.
No, I don't think so.
If you have something about half that size.
Yeah, we could try that.
We might be in business.
Maybe we'll
go to Memphis.
Or a special show at Graceland. That'd be pretty cool.
Oh, geez. That'd be wonderful.
We could do it in that the television room.
Yeah, or in Sun Records, or on the Lisa Marie.
Oh, yeah. Was that the plane?
Uh-huh. It's still
there. I've been on there. It's great. Okay, well, if you want to get in touch with us like Karen did, Karen, be a little safer next time. It's a bike, okay? You can go on to our website, stuffyoushouldknow.com. Check out our social links there. Or you can send us an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater. Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.